Welcome to today's program. My name is Jim Armitage. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Nebraska Medical Center. And today I'm joined by a colleague of mine, Dr. Matthew Lunning, who is an associate professor of medicine also at UNMC. Now, these are the disclosures that are pertinent for today's discussions. Now, today's presentation is going to discuss new directions in the treatment of relapsed or refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. This is a disease that is a success story in modern oncology, and we cure most people, but not anywhere nearly everybody. And how to deal with these patients who don't get cured by standard therapy has been a real issue. Dr. Lunning is going to discuss key data from recent publications and conferences on current and emerging approaches for the treatment of these patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who failed standard therapy. And he's going to present to us current and potential practice implications. And then we will have a discussion about how to see how he thinks through these clinical problems. At this point, I am pleased to turn the presentation over to Matt.
Thank you, Jim. And I want to first start off with how can you not have a talk about relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma without talking about and leading in about talking about cellular therapy? And as you can see here, this is just not a picture of the number of satellites revolving around the Earth, but the number of clinical trials that have cellular therapy component in development. You can see many of them live in the phase 1-2 realm, but some are making their way into pivotal clinical trials. And we now have several cellular therapies which are marketed in the commercial environment. Many of those led their approval through the pathway of relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Why is that? Well, as Dr. Armitage alluded to, many of the patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, approximately 60 to 70%, are cured with first-line chemoimmunotherapy, namely rituximab R-CHOP, potentially being unseated based upon data from the POLARIX trial, which is beyond this presentation today. However, for those patients who have primary refractory disease or have refractory disease to two lines or more, or who have relapsed within 12 months of autologous stem cell transplant, the prognosis is quite poor. You can see here, based upon the Scholar 1 data, that the median overall survival of these three groups is approximately 6 months. So again, I'll repeat that. The median overall survival in these three populations is around 6 months. So that's what has made CAR T-cell or cellular therapy such an important part of the management of relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Recently, though, the landscape has been changing to the point where now we knew CAR T-cells were very well cemented in the second line or third line and beyond treatment. However, now based upon randomized trials and an enriched high-risk population of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, based upon the randomized data, now CAR T-cell is moving into the second line. And so really, when I think about a relapse refractory patient, I used to ask myself, are these patients auto-transplant eligible? But now I'm asking myself, are these patients CAR T-cell eligible? Should they still get an auto-transplant? Or is there another therapy that they should be getting in lieu of CAR T or an auto-transplant? So really, we're walking down the path of yes, maybe, or no. So let's go through the emerging data that led to the second line approval of CAR T-cell therapy. The first trial was the ZUMA-7 trial, and this pitted axi-cel, a CD19 CAR-modified T-cell product, against standard of care. And as you can see, this was a randomized trial. Those going to axi-cel could receive no bridging therapy, whereas the patients in the standard of care received standard second-line chemotherapy, and if they had a response amenable to transplant, proceeded on to transplant, versus those randomized to axi-cel went on to receive axi-cel once the patients were apheresed. They received lymphodepleting chemotherapy followed by infusion of the CAR-modified T-cells. The primary endpoint here was median EFS, and you can see here there was a statistically significant outcome in favor of axi-cel with a hazard ratio of 0.39. You can see the two-year event-free survival in the AxiCell arm was 40.5, and in the standard of care arm, only 16.3. Who benefited from in this trial? Well, a statistician would tell you here that all patients appeared to benefit regardless of subtype or different age characteristics of their disease benefited if they received the AxiCell product. You can see here that the dots are fairly well aligned on the side with confidence intervals not crossing one. Overall survival, while this is the most mature of our randomized trials, was in favor of Azuma-7, and we'll have to see with longer follow-up whether or not this trends towards a difference in overall survival for the CAR T-cell group. A second trial that was done concurrently but was reported later was a TRANSFORM trial. So this was done in a similar patient population of those patients who had either primary refractory or diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which relapsed within 1 year of the end of chemotherapy. Slightly different in this trial, which was still randomized to standard of care versus CAR T-cell, was in this trial patients could receive bridging chemotherapy in the experimental arm and then go on to receive the liso-cel CD19 CAR-modified T-cells. In the standard of care arm, if those patients had a response amenable to stem cell transplant, they would continue to proceed on. In this situation, or in this trial, these patients did have their CAR T cells manufactured or apheresed before, and then if an event were to occur in the standard of care arm, they could go on and have a crossover to receive liso-cel on trial. Whereas in the Azuma-7 trial, patients would have to receive their CAR T-cell therapy after a progression event in the standard of care arm, either in the commercial environment or potentially in a different clinical trial. So as you can see here, the median follow-up is much shorter in the TRANSFORM trial compared to the Azuma-7 trial at 6.2 months. However, there was a event-free survival advantage in the liso-cel arm at 10.1 months versus the standard of care arm with a median of 2.3 months. Very similar outcomes in both standard of care arms in this trial. Again, a trend towards overall survival, potential differences, but we'll continue to need longer follow-up to see how this plays out. Another trial that was done concurrently with the TRANSFORM trial was a pilot trial. And I like to highlight this because I think some individuals think that if you're not a transplant candidate, then you're no longer a CAR T-cell candidate. Well, the pilot trial really challenged that. And I'll show you here on this slide that the different eligibility. So this was meant for patients who were not transplant eligible. And that can be defined by many different criteria, but you had to have at least one of these, which was either age greater than 70, an ECOG performance status of 2, a DLCO of less than 60%, a LVEF less than 50% but greater than 40%, a creatinine clearance less than 60 mils per minute but greater than 30 mils per minute. So you can see here that this is on the right-hand side is a kind of a Venn diagram showing of overlapping risk factors, mainly driven by age, but certainly there were some other aspects that I think are clearly relevant, namely creatinine clearance, especially in advanced age individuals. And so in my mind, there is no upper limit of age for CAR T-cell therapy to be delivered. So based upon the pilot data, there was very similar overall response rates and CR rates that had been seen in the TRANSCEND data set. And so we're really talking about overall response rates in the 70 to 80% with CR rates in the 50 to 60%. So I believe in this pilot population, this is still a reasonable option. And this was seen in the expansion of the label to transplant not eligible patients in the second line setting. So as we think about transitioning CAR T-cell to the commercial environment, one of the things that has been noted as we've been trying to use this in the third line and beyond is really patient access. So right now, I think the data supports that maybe 1 in 5 patients who could get CAR T-cell are actually getting their CAR T-cell. And so why is that? Well, I think the question is you're really looking at what I call the intent to CAR, or the brain to vein time. So when you and I, as an oncologist and the patient and their family, sit down and say we want to move to CAR T-cell, there are certain hurdles that exist in this brain to vein time before we even apherese the individual. That can be prior authorization, negotiation of single case agreements, allocation of apheresis of slot time. And so really, I think in an intent to CAR analysis, we have to take in consideration the brain to vein time. In clinical trials, we've really only looked at the vein to vein time, or the time taken between apheresis of the T cells to reinfusion, and then incorporating it into the outcomes in the post-infusion environment, otherwise called the vein to gain time, at least in my opinion. So, you know, I think that we've figured out the vein-to-vein time. We've started to figure out bridging during the vein-to-vein time, but we really need to think about the pre-apheresis or the bridging during the brain-to-vein time that really could impact the fidelity of the CAR T-cells. I think that CAR T-cells, we need to continue to add on to them. I think the outcomes could be better, especially in the high-risk population, so we need to find adjunctive therapies to try to make the CAR T-cells better. We really need to, we've sorted out how well CAR T cells will do in the second line in early CAR T cell failures, but what is the role for CAR T cell in late failures? In my opinion, those patients should still go on to receive second line chemotherapy and autologous stem cell transplant, as they, I still believe that is a curative intent option, but CAR T cells could still be used if those patients relapse. We continue to learn about the mechanisms of CAR T cell failure and trying to enhance our CAR T cells through clinical trials. And as we pivot now to talking about non-CAR T-cell therapies in relapse refractory large cell lymphoma, we really need to think about these therapies as potential allies to cellular therapy rather than adversaries and an adversarial relationship that would work towards not promoting patients to getting CAR T-cell therapy. So the first trial, non-CAR T-cell trial that I'll talk about in the relapse refractory DLBCL spectrum is polatuzumab, bendamustine, rituximab versus bendamustine, rituximab. And this was a trial that was very small, but was a randomized phase two. You can see here that the overall response rate and the CR rate was much higher in the POLA-BR arm. What's obviously missing in this trial is a polatuzumab only arm, but you have to think that the heavy lifting is being done by the polatuzumab here. The surprise was that in this trial, there was an overall survival advantage in those patients who received polatuzumab BR. And so that led the FDA to come knocking, and polatuzumab BR was approved for the treatment of relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Many of you may know in the NCCN guidelines now, it now states polatuzumab plus minus bendamustine plus minus rituximab. So it has given us the option on how to use this regimen in clinical practice. And this still remains my number one bridging strategy in the pre-apheresis environment, is to give single agent polatuzumab or single agent polatuzumab rituximab if still rituximab sensitive. Here's median overall survival curve showing the survival advantage of polatuzumab rituximab at 12.4 months versus 4.7 months. Many of us thought this may be a fluke, so a larger expansion study was done showing very similar results in the expansion cohort with the median PFS of the POLA-BR being 6.6 months and the overall survival being 12.5 months. So again, confirming the initial data set. The next regimen that I'd like to highlight is kind of a successive model of analyzing data. So the initial study was the L-MIND study, which was tafasitamab, which is a CD19 antibody paired with lenalidomide, or immunomodulatory agent. And you can see in the, individually, these neither of these drugs would get response rates in the 60%, but together you can see here the overall response rate was 60% with a whopping 42% CR rate. And so this was in a an early, so at second line, up to I believe four lines of therapy could be enrolled in this trial. What they then did based upon their initial data set was look at a retrospective cohort. And so these were in the ReMIND study. And so they looked at those patients who had received tafasitamab lenalidomide, and then they matched them to try to with certain disease characteristics and compared them to retrospective outcomes with lenalidomide monotherapy. And you can see here just in a prospective/retrospective review of just the significant advantage with not only in regards to best overall response rate, but also CR rate. One of the unique characteristics of this, of the L-MIND data, has been the durability that's been seen if a patient can achieve a CR. And this is, I believe, now out to 3-year follow-up, showing that there potentially may be a tail to this curve. However, it should be noted that patients do need to continue on the tafasitamab indefinitely, whereas the lenalidomide is stopped after 12 cycles or 1 year. They went on in the ReMIND2 trial to look at further regimens compared against the prospective TAFA-LEN regimen. You can see here the advantage in overall response rate as well as in CR rate compared to pooled systemic therapies, also in comparison to bendamustine rituximab, and then lastly in regards to R-GEM-OX, which is a favorite relapse refractory regimen that some may give, especially if a transplant may be patient population or those who are felt not to be transplant eligible. So really, I think tafasitamab lenalidomide has really taken off the table lenalidomide rituximab in the relapse refractory large cell lymphoma space. I think that there is data in a retrospective fashion that does show some interesting, is supported as interesting in regards to utilization of tafasitamab lenalidomide potentially over chemoimmunotherapy in patients who have previously been refractory to chemoimmunotherapy in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. The last drug that I'll talk about is loncastuximab tesirine, or LONCA-T, which is an antibody drug conjugate against CD79B. It carries a novel PDB warhead, so this is different than drugs like brentuximab vedotin. This is a pyrrolobenzodiazepine, so it's a different mechanism of action. This drug is given uniquely at a higher dose for the first 2 cycles, and then the dose is halved, and using certain supportive measures to reduce the risk of pleural effusions or edema that had been seen with different dosing and different schedules. You can see here in the study, the overall response rate was 48.3% in all patients with a CR rate of 24.1 months. Again, what is interesting here is that for those patients that do respond, there may be the potential for durability. And at least at this data cut, in those patients who were in CR, the median had not yet been reached. What were the side effect profile of LONCA-T? Well, one of those things that we don't really know what to do with is increased GGT. So whether or not this is a laboratory abnormality, there was not a significant number of liver issues reported with this drug. There can be some hematologic side effects, but mainly the one that I call out and use the pre and post dosing of dexamethasone is peripheral edema or pleural effusions. And so this is something to know about this drug and to be aware of. So with that, I'll go into my concluding statements. So I think CAR T-cell is now an option in primary refractory or early relapse diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Autologous stem cell transplant remains an option for late relapses, so those who relapse greater than 1 year post-induction therapy. And multiple agents for relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma are now available, but there's minimal data on the sequencing before or after CAR T-cell, especially those that target CD19. And with that, open it up for some discussion.
Really good job, Matt. I enjoyed that tremendously. But I do have a number of questions, some more less exactly related to what you said, but are things that will have to be taken into account by the people listening to your presentation when they try to use the data. First one, we know that diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is not a uniform disease. And there are some famous subsets like double hits, and then there's a new molecular classification. Do any of those subsets impact your decision-making when you're treating somebody with relapsed refractory disease?
I think it depends upon what I'm doing. So I think one of the unique things and that I tried to show in the forest plot in the ZUMA-7 data is that really cellular therapy or CAR T-cell therapy directed at CD19 has been agnostic to certain molecular features, you know, whether or not you're going in through gene expression profiling or if you're using IHC to define subtypes or even your double hits or triple hits. So it seems like CAR T-cells can take care of the worst of the worst and with regards to primary refractory disease or double refractory disease, and it can take care of double hits just as well.
All right. There's a famous saying in medicine that I remember from medical school that you shouldn't ever be the first or last to take up a new treatment. Are there any of the things you discuss that would be you shouldn't do it yet because we don't have enough data, you shouldn't be the first, or the opposite end? If you're not doing them, you're not practicing good medicine. Which any of those you put in one of the two extreme categories?
You know, I think I have caution about giving a CD19 monoclonal antibody or CD19 antibody drug conjugate, especially if I'm going to go or apherese a person for CAR T cell in the next 30 to 60 days. I think there is data to support with tafasitamab, while it is in vivo data, that you do see downregulation of the CD19 antigen on the cell surface. And so if you're going to try to go in and use a pre-apheresis bridging or a bridging strategy with one of those agents, if the patient can wait, you know, 100 days, at least the data supports that there is CD19 recovery potentially after exposure to those agents. But I don't really know that there's a significant amount of data of, you know, one of those agents with kind of apheresis and then reinfusion of CAR T-cell and to know truly what to do in that situation. That being said, you can't do a CAR T-cell on a person that's not alive. And so, you know, if that therapy is felt to be necessary to keep the individual alive, to get them to have the potential to get a CAR T-cell, I guess I can't fault that from that manner. But that is why I currently still use polatuzumab-based either pre-apheresis or post-apheresis bridging if I need to. And I do sometimes, in significant bulky disease, potentially use bendamustine, hopefully after apheresis if I need to.
Matt, do you think there is a patient that you could tell us that shouldn't have CAR T-cell therapy? There's a patient that's referred to you, a subset of patients, what are their characteristics that just shouldn't get CAR T-cell therapy? Or is there no one?
Yeah, I think, you know, personally, when I see, you know, people say, I've sent you a referral for CAR T-cell therapy, you know, I think it's a much broader consultation that I'm seeing than for relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And so I think CAR T-cells are one of the options. To say who shouldn't get a CAR T-cell, I think you probably shouldn't give a CAR T-cell to a person who's refractory to another CD19 CAR T-cell. That's certainly one population that I can easily call out. I do think that there needs to be clinical trials, though, where patients being eligible to receive a different cellular therapy, potentially with a different mechanism, either a different construct or a second antigen, you know, that then could take out 19 and 20 or 19 and 22. If you think about organ function and performance status, you know, performance status may be, you know, a situation where you may exclude them from CAR T-cell. But remember, performance status is often very subjective. And I think that, you know, if the performance status is poor and it's because of disease characteristics, then I may have a risk-benefit discussion with the patient about proceeding or not. But if the performance status is due to some other comorbidity not related to the lymphoma, then I'm very concerned that even a grade 1 CRS or a grade 1 ICANS, you know, would be significantly detrimental to their quality of life or potentially be lethal, then I would advise against CAR T-cell. But I think we have to see the patients in order to make that determination.
Does radiotherapy still have a place in your treatment plans for patients like this?
Yeah, I think that that's an area where there's a dearth of data. You know, I think there was some initial concerns about what radiation does to the circulating, you know, CAR T cells in the post-CAR T cell environment. Where CAR T cells don't always work very well is in the area of bulky or large lesions. I use the analogy of, CAR T cells like peeling an onion. You've got to get all the way to the core of the onion in order to eradicate the disease. And I think the intent here is curative for each CAR T cell that's being done. So in that regard, if I see a lesion that becomes PET negative, but the size, started off in quite a, quote unquote, a bulky range and then reduced by 50% or more, I may have the discussion about post CAR T cell radiation with that patient, because I am concerned that that's the area where the CAR T cells are struggling to get to the core.
As you look to the future, do you think that the bispecific antibodies are a threat to CAR T cell therapy? That is, could they replace it?
I'm not sure that they will replace it. When I mentioned the allies versus adversary conversation, or bullet point, I think that's the class that I'm most concerned about potentially being adversarial rather than an alliance with CAR T cell. It isn't such that the drugs like epcoritamab or glofitamab that are likely to find their way into relapse refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma inhibit a significant the same antigen like tafasitamab or Lonca-T does. But what we don't know is what is the fitness or the fidelity of the T cell in a patient who progresses through bispecifics, and then you try to manufacture and take out those same T cells that have just been fighting a war that's been brought to them by the bispecifics, and how well do those CAR T cells manufacture and how well do they work? I think there is emerging data with bispecifics after CAR T cell showing that it can work, and there are CRs, and so I see it right now positioned after CAR T-cell. I think if we're going to move into the bispecific before CAR T-cell world, it best be done in a clinical trial where you can then look at what the manufacturing output is rather than doing it by a real-world experience. But I fear that we're only going to learn by real-world experience once we see these drugs enter the relapse refractory large cell space. So
now, one last question, a very practical one for the people listening to this presentation. We've known for some time, we think we have known, that if you couldn't have an autologous transplant or rarely an allotransplant, and you truly had progressive or refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, your only hope was direct divine intervention to be cured. That is, that was your chance. Now, you've just showed us that there are these other therapies, CAR T cell therapy, and perhaps some of the others, can literally snatch people from the jaws of death. You can cure people who are in a terrible position. Has salvage therapy become so effective that you shouldn't be referring people to palliative care? You should always give them a chance to try to be cured by things like CAR T cell therapy.
I think it truly is what is driving them towards palliative care. If it is the disease, I think that in my opinion, unless they have end-stage COPD or end-stage heart failure, end-stage liver disease, at least allowing them to have that discussion about what do they feel from a risk benefit standpoint, is it worth that to them, and is it worth that to the commitment to the family? That CAR T cell is. It is a logistical process. It is being away from your home, your farm, your community for a period of time. But it's different than other therapies like allotransplant, right? Allotransplant, often that carrot is dangled in front of people, but you have to have good disease control in order to have likely good outcomes. Here with CAR T cell, yes, the amount of disease may matter, but there's still patients that I know that are alive because of cellular therapy that wouldn't otherwise be just based upon the odds.
All right, Matt, thank you very much. Thank you very much for that wonderful presentation. I hope all of you listening have enjoyed it and will benefit by this and start applying some of these things to your practice that you might not have thought of before.